I want to work through, just for a moment or two, our covenant to each other. I feel like I need to do that because this is the pastoral part of me as it relates to our church, and that we cannot stop being the church just because we don't meet in the church. And so what I want to do is I want to read through each of these covenants, and I want you to give yourself a value. So that if you give yourself a 10, it means that you did this really well this week. And if you give yourself a 5, it means that you were mediocre or you didn't have an opportunity to do that kind of a thing this week. So I just want you to think through reflectively for each of these covenant principles and ask yourself, as a member of this church, as a member of the kingdom of God, how well did I do with each of these principles, these covenant principles that we've been talking about? And then I'll get into the message for this morning. So the first one is pray conversationally and intercessionally on a daily basis. How well did you do? What value would you give yourself in relationship to that principle? Number two, remember to praise and worship God on a daily basis. So regardless of how busy we are, what our circumstances are to us, have we praised and worshiped God on a daily basis? What value would you give to yourself this past week? Number three, practice loving and sacrificial community. How well did we do with that? Did we look for opportunities, or were those opportunities looking for us? There's a difference between those two things. Number four, help the fragile and vulnerable among you. So, were we able to help anybody who needed help in whatever way, not just materially or substantively, but words of encouragement, time that we spent with people in conversation who needed that from us? Number five, be ready to share whatever you have with those in need. So the longer we are shut down, I'm assuming the more people there will be who will have something in need. So be ready to share and to give in whatever way. But this past week, how did we do? What value would we give ourselves? Was it a 5? Was it a 7? Was it a 10? Number six, continue to be diligent in your financial support. I want to thank all of you who were able to send something in this past week. It's essential. And I just want to thank you for being diligent in that way, and for all of us to continue to be supportive financially so that we can continue to do what we are doing. As you know, I'm trying to send out mass texts on a regular basis to people in our church. I continue to try and meet in some fashion or another through texting or phone calls with people in my Bible study and people in my small group on Thursday mornings. So let's just maintain that contact. Let's do that ministry to each other in whatever way we can. And then number seven, continue to follow us on Conway Alliance Church and just be here Sunday mornings and be a part of that community time that begins at 10:15. So that we can share with each other and connect with each other in some fashion. That's something. And so it's not, and it doesn't look like we're going to be able to get out of our houses anytime soon. And so whatever connection we make is a significant connection. So Sunday morning, that community time is really important for us to reconnect. So those are just the covenantal principles that I think that we need to keep in mind and do and be diligent in as we continue to be the church here in Conway. So I want to begin with a story. Many of you have heard this story before, but it's very pertinent to what I will be talking about this morning about the great I Am statement that Jesus gave in relationship to Mary and Martha and the death of Lazarus, where he says, I am the resurrection and the life. This story is about my father. My dad died when he was, I believe, 74 years of age. And he lived a life devoid of any relationship with God almost his entire life. He wasn't interested. It wasn't relevant to him. He trusted in his own way of seeing how he ought to live his life. He kind of bought into the idea that that if he's good enough, then heaven would be a possibility for him. We used to share Christ with him. I did when I was in high school. I did when I was in college. Not every day, but we talked about that. My mother certainly did. And during those times in his life when he had some kind of physical crisis, like a stroke or a heart attack, he was very open and receptive to pastors visiting him and praying to him. But he never really made a commitment during those times. In November, in the November before he passed away, in January of 2002, he had a congestive heart failure and was in a skilled nursing facility for some time. And the pastor of the church that my mother was attending went to visit him and presented the gospel to him. And afterwards, he said to both my mother and me that he felt like that maybe this was a real and authentic decision on his part. So a few months went by, and then in January of 2002, his health began to deteriorate again, and he had such a negative experience in that skilled nursing home that he absolutely refused to go back to that. And so my mother called the doctor, and the doctor said, well, look, there's nothing more that we can do for him. He's dying from congestive heart failure. And that's the best. And so if he wants to stay at home, just make him comfortable. And so that's what they did. His health continued to decline throughout the course of the day. And my oldest brother, who's 8 years older than me, at some point had to stay in the room because my father was in great distress and was flailing around, slowly drowning to death from congestive heart failure. It always makes me think when somebody who smokes says something like, well, you know, you got to die from something. If they had seen how my father had died, I don't think they would be so trivial about that, because he took, I would say, about 6 hours of where he laid in that bed and he flailed around and his lungs filled with fluid. And during that time, my mother was in the hallway. Well, my brother held him down so he would not fall off the bed and injure himself. That entire time, my brother was in there just trying to comfort him in whatever way he could. But while he was in there, my mother was walking up and down the hallway outside the bedroom door, and she could hear him in that room. And he would begin to say, oh, hell, over and over again. He would say, oh, hell. And my mother opened the door and walked into the room, and she said, no, Bill, Jesus is in heaven. Pray to Jesus in heaven. And my mother said to me, because I was not there, but she told me about this afterwards, she said it was the oddest thing. She said it's like he switched, and he began to say, oh, God, more hopefully, oh, God, over and over again. He would say, oh, God. And my mother was in the room when she said, and then he did this really odd thing. She said, I saw him on that bed, and just before he died, this is a true story, he threw his arms out in front of him and he said, I am. I am. I am. Just like that. Now, any of you who know anything about the Old Testament, you know that the holiest name for God is I am who I am. And so I think there was a part of my father who saw God as he was leaving this world and going into the next, and he uttered those holy words, I am, I am. But I also think that he could see God, and God was saying, come to me, and my father said, I am, I am. And then he died. Now, I tell you that story because for a long time, my father never was concerned about dying. It didn't matter to him what happened after death. But when he got close to death, it really mattered. And he wanted to know that there was something there for him because he was afraid of what might happen if provision was not made for him in this life. So when we come to the story then of Jesus and Mary and Martha in John chapter 11 and the death of Lazarus, Jesus answers the fundamental question that everybody there wrestled with, the thing that they saw almost on a daily basis, and that was death. So for women back then, the life expectancy was probably somewhere around in the late teens to mid-20s because of how many women died through childbirth. The mortality rate for men was also relatively low, not just because of health reasons, but because many young men died in war and in bondage as slaves. So death was always there. It was always something that was present. And it was something that no one knew how to defeat. And not just death itself, but the question, what happens to us when we die? What's beyond this? And that's a question that every culture and every society in the history of the world has always wrestled with. And it has been among the most troubling of all questions. And so what happens? What happens to us when we leave this world and when we go on into the next? Is there a next world? And if there is a next world, what is the criteria for being able to go to a good place versus a bad place? So when we look at this story then in John chapter 11, it's one of the longer narratives. And this particular narrative is very similar to the I am statements, I am the gate and I am the good shepherd found in chapter 9, John chapter 9. Those two I ams hinged themselves on what happened to the blind man in chapter 9. Sorry, chapter 9 and then chapter 10. In chapter 11, the great I am statement, I am the resurrection and the life, hinges on the death of Lazarus. And it's a lengthy reading, so I'm not going to go into all of that here, and particularly today, although I will next week, because I really need to set this particular story up in a more helpful way. But understand this, that when Jesus brought Lazarus back from the dead, that among all of his miracles, all of the signs that he did, it was this that without question established his divinity. He held the keys over life and death. He held the keys over the death of Lazarus, who was in the grave for 3 days. So I'm getting a little ahead of myself. But the Jews back then believed that when a person died, the spirit hovered above the dead body for as many as 3 days. And so after 3 days, they were reasonably assured that the spirit left that body, which is why Lazarus was in the grave for 3 days, because then, and only then, it would be, the evidence was incontrovertible. The evidence was clear that the Spirit had left Lazarus, and now it was Jesus and Jesus only who raised Lazarus from the dead. This would have been an astounding thing for all of them to see. But before any of that happens, Martha asks this question about Lazarus. What are you going to do? And so Jesus said, your brother, this is verse 23 of chapter 11. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. So this was a statement of faith here that was pretty significant. I mean, there was a positiveness, there was a confidenceness, just like what Stacy was singing earlier. She had lost her brother. She had lost her kinsman redeemer. She had lost the person who would protect her because he was a male and because she was a female. Her life and Mary's life was much more at risk. So they were much more, even more dependent upon God than what they were before. And so Mary makes this astounding statement of faith, which Jesus follows up by saying in verse 25, Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And so Jesus makes this statement, I am the person who has the question, who answers the question about what happens after this life. I am the person who provides the means, who facilitates the way in which a person can achieve the resurrection and eternal life. Jesus is saying this about himself. And he not only just says this, but then he goes and he does it. And this is an astounding thing. So verse 26, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She believed in the resurrection. The piece she hadn't put together yet was the role that Jesus played with the resurrection. Do you believe this? My father died believing in the last minute that Jesus was the solution. He was the answer for the resurrected life. So that was a rhetorical question that Jesus was asking of Martha. But this rhetorical question has no time limit. That question that he asks of Martha is no less true of us than it was of her. Do we believe that Jesus is the resurrection and the life, and that whoever believes in him, even though he dies, yet we will live? Do we believe that? Is that where our trust and our faith is in? Because you can see, as we work through all of the great I am statements, it's now culminating itself into something that is kind of hard to top. Jesus is at last answering the pivotal question that everybody had in that day in regard to their life, the quality and the nature of their life, and what would happen to them after they died in this world. So, there was a Rasmussen report back in 2017 that asked this question, do you believe in life after death? Is there life after death? Americans sure think so. The Rasmussen reports in a national telephone online survey finds that 62% of American adults believe in life after death. Just 17% do not, and 20% are still unsure if there is an afterlife. Those are startling numbers, because I can tell you that probably 100 years or certainly 500 years ago, those numbers would not have been anywhere close to that. It would have been 97% believed in some kind of an afterlife, 98%. And so there's a significant percentage of people who do not believe in the afterlife. And if they don't believe that,
then they don't really believe in the necessity of Jesus being the resurrection and the life, the primary purpose and reason for which he came to earth. So the culture is changing. And so in the same way that he was answering these questions to Mary and Martha, we must ask them of ourselves. So let's give a little context. Well, let me just say this first. I just want to say a couple more things about his claim about being the resurrection and the life before I move on. This was Jesus' final and most spectacular sign before his crucifixion and death. This sign was intended to warm people up to the idea that not only could he defeat death in the lives of people around him, but that he too could defeat his own physical death, thereby demonstrating supremacy over the curse that comes from the fall, and that is death. What people saw happen to Lazarus, they would remember when Jesus died, so that when he raised himself up, it would be easier to believe because they saw what he did with Lazarus as well. So when we think about all this, I think that to make it applicable to ourselves, we have to ask this question within our own culture and in our own time. Maybe some of you remember that several years ago, I asked this question. Why doesn't the good news sound like the good news anymore? Why doesn't the good news sound like the good news anymore? I mean, it's startling, really, that when you read in the New Testament about those who came to faith, and when they left there, and they went to other places and they shared about Jesus and they told them the gospel, the good news, how receptive people would be, how excited they were, because hope had been given to them in a way that they had never experienced hope before. But when you, in today's context, when you talk to people about the gospel of Jesus Christ, you don't get that same response. They don't really even know what the gospel means. They're not really even convinced that the gospel is relevant or applicable. The culture has changed that much. People really aren't all that concerned about what happens to them after they die because they've been told other things. So this is the gospel. It is the proclamation of the coming of the kingdom of God and of the forgiveness of sins. It means reconciliation with and restoration of or within ourselves. Restoration with the created order. Restoration between ourselves as human beings. And restoration as adopted sons with God. This is what the cross, the crucifixion event achieved for us. This is the gospel. But this isn't as important to people as it used to be. So, because I think that most people in their own mind think or have in the, believe or have been informed that death really isn't a big deal. For many people today, especially, they've been taught what is called the annihilation theory. That when we die, the body and the soul ceases to exist. And that would be kind of a materialist, a person like who believes that only the material world exists and nothing else. And so when we die, whatever you might call a soul just ceases to exist. But that's not what happens to us instinctively, though, is it? I mean, deep down inside, we think, that doesn't sound right. There's got to be something more. Some people believe in a thing called universal salvation, that because we are sincere and that we believe that we live mostly a good life and that we do nice things or good works, that God will overlook anything that we've done wrong because he's all loving. He overlooks our sin. And if there is any punishment, it's limited to the degree of the rewards that we receive in heaven. So some people get a lot of stones and gems in their crown, and some people don't. And the people who don't weren't quite as nice as the people who were. There are many people who believe this. That's not what the Bible teaches, but this is what they believe. But maybe they haven't read Romans 3, verses 10 through 12, where he quotes King David in Psalm 14. There was no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. There is no one who is in essence good. There is no one who is perfect. There's no one who's really interested in being perfect. There is no one who can match the goodness and the perfection of God. And until we can do that, then heaven is not really a possibility of ours. And the only way we can do that, the gospel says, is because of what Jesus has done for us. And we know this as the substitutionary atonement theory, that Christ pays the penalty of our fallenness and our sin. It's what Christ has done, not what we can do. That we can be resurrected, that we can be restored, that we can have an eternal life with God, if we trust in what Jesus Christ did for us on the cross 2,000 years ago. Now, maybe you might want to say, well, that's what Paul says. What does Jesus have to say about that? Matthew 10:28, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Be afraid of that person. And who is that person? That's God. That's God. So maybe we think a little too highly of ourselves still. And we should take into account what Paul says in Ephesians 2:1, where he says, as for you, you were dead in your trespasses and sins, transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of the world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ even when we were dead in transgressions. It is by grace you have been saved. We can be resurrected because of the grace of God. But we have to trust in the grace of God in order to be resurrected. But I want to just focus for a minute on verse 1 of Ephesians 2. As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins. And so it's as if we do not exist. It's as if our lives have been so compromised by the sin and the brokenness and the fallenness that in comparison to God, we are dead. Now, I want to go back to Martha for just a minute. Why do you think Martha would have said what she said long before Paul said what he said here about being dead in our transgressions and sins. But what might have given Martha confidence that there was a resurrection? Why would that have been meaningful? What would have spoken to her about something that occurred in the past? Because there was something profound that occurred in the past. And it was read this morning during our call to worship. Brianna read from Ezekiel, verse 37, verses 1 through 14. And so what I want to do is I want to spend the balance of our time on Ezekiel 37, verses 1 through 14, to set the stage for next week about why Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Because when Paul says, you are dead in your trespasses and sins, I'm pretty sure what he had in mind was Ezekiel 37, verses 1 through 14. I'm also sure that this is a this is a This is one of the great stories in the Old Testament that had a lot to do with the restoration of Israel after they had been destroyed and deported finally by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, who was the one that completely razed Jerusalem and utterly destroyed the temple. But I want to give you a little bit of background on that too before we go into it. So this account, that this vision that Ezekiel records, occurred around 600 BC. Jerusalem in 586 was about to be sacked by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar II, Nebuchadnezzar the Great. Judah was being punished because of their extreme idolatry in the preceding years. So Nebuchadnezzar was an arm of discipline by God because of Israel's idolatry in the preceding years. Two particular kings, although there were many kings who participated in this, but two particular kings were phenomenally evil. They were among the last two kings of Judah in the south in Jerusalem. They were Ahaz and Manasseh. Both Ahaz and Manasseh worshipped the god Molech, a demonic god that specialized in child sacrifice. So when Nebuchadnezzar surrounded Jerusalem as a part of God's discipline on Judah for their idolatry, there were one-third who were killed in a battle with Nebuchadnezzar in the Kidron Valley. So if you can go to the map there, there's a map. So you can see where the Kidron Valley is. That's Jerusalem on that giant plateau. And the Kidron Valley is on the right. And that's where an army of Jerusalem would have gone out and fought Nebuchadnezzar, and they lost. There were thousands that were slain in that valley right there, and they were dead. And then one-third died in Jerusalem because Nebuchadnezzar, it was about an 18-month, maybe a 30-month siege that surrounded Jerusalem. You can read about that siege in the Book of Lamentations, and you can read about the horrors of that siege, and part of which was that things got so bad in Jerusalem in terms of food that parents practiced cannibalism on their children. So if you get upset about God using Nebuchadnezzar as a means of discipline, understand that what took place in Jerusalem was worse than anything the preceding tribes from the time of Moses on had done in Palestine, in that particular region. So do you see where it says the Hinnom Valley or Gehenna, that green arrow on the map? I'm sorry, that red arrow on the map? The Kinnon Valley is right below the southern wall of Jerusalem. And on top of that wall, Ahaz and Manasseh had a giant idol of Molech. And they, and under particularly Manasseh, who was the son of Ahaz, he was so evil that it says that the streets ran red with the blood of its people, and that they sacrificed their children, their firstborn, on that wall. And it incinerated their children, and they fell into that valley called the Hinnom Valley, which in Jesus' day, he referred to as Gehenna. And in that valley, it became a giant garbage dump. It was so associated with the evil of the preceding kings that the only thing that they could find a use for it was to throw food and furniture and dead things, and then it would slowly burn, and the stench would belch up into the air with smoke. And Jesus would say that people who would not turn to him would end up in Gehenna, that place of evil, that place where worthless things were thrown. So, when we look at this map then, and we understand what's going on, Israel, Jerusalem was punished. They lost one third of their population in that valley of the Kidron Valley. And you think, well, look, they were just defending the city. There were any number of those soldiers in the Kidron Valley who fought for Judah who offered their firstborn to Molech on top of that wall. So Israel was in a terrible state. And God judged them and punished them because of the condition that they were in. Now, 2,000 years later, if you see where the green arrow is, that's where Golgotha is. That's where they crucified Jesus. And maybe in all likelihood, that cross or those crosses faced the Hinnom Valley or Gehenna, where the firstborn were sacrificed to Satan. And Jesus, the firstborn of God, sacrificed himself on behalf of us, even as he looked down towards Gehenna itself. What a change. What a powerful image. So let's read then, with that as the background, let's just read a little bit then from Ezekiel 37, beginning with verse 1, because this is what I think Martha had in mind. For as evil and as wicked as Israel was, look what God does in Ezekiel 37. The hand of the Lord was on me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of the valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them. And I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry, meaning that they were very brittle, that they were, there was nothing, this sort of like being left in the earth for, it was like Lazarus being left in the tomb for 3 days. There was no spirit hovering. These bones were very dry. There was no possibility of any life being associated with them. That's why he says what he says. He asked me, that is God asked me, son of man, can these bones live? I said, Sovereign Lord, you alone know. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them. And skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. Come, breath from the four winds, and breathe into these slain that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them, and they came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. Then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the people of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off because we are dead in our trespasses and sins. When Paul says we are dead in our trespasses and sins, it's this bleak. It's this stark. This is our condition. We are those bones in our soul. Therefore prophesy and say to them, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, my people. I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open up your graves and bring you up from them. I will put my spirit in you and you will live. And I will settle you in your own land. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken, and I have done it, declares the Lord. The valley of the dry bones is about God's ability and grace to resurrect and restore those dead in their sin for his purpose and glory. The valley of dry bones would have been a well-known narrative that would have taken on new meaning with the raising of Lazarus. The valley of dry bones is also a very helpful metaphor for how we should see Ephesians 2:1. And why, when Jesus said, "Be afraid of he who can store both, who can destroy both soul and body," because if he did what he did to Israel because of their sin, because of their lack of repentance, because of their involvement in the kind of idolatry that they were, then we must believe that we are not exempt from that either. That those of us who are without Christ should be very concerned about what happens in the afterlife apart from Christ. So bringing this back around then, I have little doubt that at some point Martha would have thought about this phenomenal vision from the book of Ezekiel. It was a vision that was used to give an explanation about how God resurrected Israel from captivity among the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Persians. But this metaphor expands itself even more about how we are relieved from our captivity to sin and to evil, and that God can raise us up even though we are dead in our trespasses and sins, even in the same way that God raised Lazarus because of his belief. God will raise us up if we believe as well. So I just want to leave that as kind of the background before we dig into Jesus' statement, "I am the resurrection and the life." Because I think that this would have had to have been part of the discussion when they were trying to give meaning to the raising of Lazarus himself. The story was too fantastic. It was too well known to not have been connected in some fashion. And so it helps to give us meaning, because I just want to say in parting, everyone here at one time without Christ was like those dry bones. Everyone here apart from Christ, we were dead in our trespasses and sins. Everyone here through Christ has the opportunity to enter into a resurrected condition and life because of Christ's great work on the cross that he declares about himself. We don't say that about him. He said that about him. And that is what we trust and what we have confidence in this morning.